Welcome to My Big Safety Challenge, a podcast all about stories of safety leadership presented by Dale Carnegie and the Board of Certified Safety Professionals.
Jay, this is a treat today because if it were not for this gentleman, I would not be sitting in this seat. And so because of the opportunity to work together along the way, it opened up some real doors for me. So it's our privilege today to have Michael Langston join us for this podcast. So Michael, we're glad to have you here. Tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, huh? And that kind of thing. Just kind of give us a little bit of the basics about you.
Yeah, so I'm from mid-Missouri, grew up small town, outside of most people would know Lake of the Ozarks, but really small town. Went to school, CMSU, and actually was going to be a pharmacist. That's what I was going to school for. After Organic Chem 3 and Calc 4 or 5, Yeah, I said, hey, there's a whole nother school, you know, medical school behind that, and all I want to do is stand on a counter that's higher than everybody else and count pills, 2, 4, 6, and I don't know why I need all this background for that, but I was like, I'm probably done with that. So I started looking around because my parents were paying for college and I had all this classes. And I was like, what else can I do with this? And I fell into a degree called industrial hygiene. And so finished out my college career and got my bachelor's in industrial hygiene, 1994. Got married that spring before. So I had one semester left to go. And didn't have any plans, what we were going to do and where we were going to go. So I started my master's, did a month or semester of a master's program in industrial hygiene. And I got picked up for an internship at a place, outside of St. Louis, fully integrated steel mill. And so I took that as kind of an internship and that internship turned into, industrial hygiene, assistant / safety engineer. And that's when my career started.
Wow. And approximately how long were you at that steel company?
Spent a little over 8 years at the steel company, and went all the way from, an intern, to the last 3 years, I was the manager of the whole department. So I had 1200 hour or salaried people and about, 3,000, steel workers, and mixed the different unions, about 7 different unions at that location.
So you had quite a combination there.
I did.
Quite a combination. Now, as all of us have learned, being in college and hearing about safety and those kind of things and getting out to the real world environment, it's a big, big switch. What were some of the things you started discovering perhaps rather quickly?
Yeah. So again, I was an industrial hygienist and I tell people I haven't been a practicing industrial hygienist for 28 years of my career. So, cause it didn't take me long. We had fully, operational coke oven that once a quarter required sampling. And, so I got to be the pump jockey. So I was the guy running out, chasing all these guys over the coke ovens, trying to check on pumps, trying to check on filter media. And I realized pretty quickly that number one, I wasn't very well liked cause they would run away from me. Because they didn't want to wear the pump and the stuff and put all these things on. But it just wasn't really fulfilling. So that's when I transitioned kind of into a safety engineer position, which they had open and available at the time. So, and then from there, I've just hung in the safety field and I've loved it.
Were there any like special lessons once you got into that safety realm in steel mill that really helped maybe guided you or directed you as your future of going that way, that some lessons you learned?
Yeah. So luckily I ran into a couple mentors because I started my safety career, complaining, sitting around with a bunch of guys, other safety engineers that had been there a longer term, you know, and we'd get biscuits and gravy in the morning, sit in their office and we'd just complain about, you know, employees won't follow rules. If all we needed was backpacks full of pink slips and we could fix the world. And so I thought that's how safety was, right? Because these guys are much older than me. They've been in the field much longer than me. And then I got probably 3 years into that career. I ran into a gentleman named Fred Ryan. and I got to be part of what's called safety awareness, his class, and got to help set that up and start having that taught to all the employees. And it really started to change, you know, kind of my mindset, how I went about safety, the reality of what safety was. It wasn't about policies, procedures. It wasn't about firing a bunch of people. It was more about trying to change their attitude towards safety. And, you know, the cool thing about that class was it was 8 hours and it was nothing to do with how to be safe. It was all about why to be safe. And I started to learn about different values and propositions and what drives people and what makes people, you know, want to do the things that they want to do. Because we all know nobody comes to work today to cut their hand off or cut a finger off, or, you know, it happens because they feel like you're trying to do something for the employers and do something for the people they work for.
So Jay, I have this question before we let Michael say a little bit more. That thing he said about safety folks who said, just give me the pink slips, let me take these people out. What's wrong with these people? Do you think that kind of attitude is still ever prevalent among safety folks today?
That's how I started my career. And you start in this compliance mode when you're fresh out of college. And yeah, if they would just do what we said, they wouldn't get hurt ever. And you think everything's about being compliant and following rules and directives. And there's some sort of, see, if you would have listened to us, you wouldn't have got hurt, which as you mature in the business, probably similar to me, you realize it has nothing to do with that. It's about people, people, people. And I think as you mature in your career, you start to come off that. But the mentorship is the part that I wish I had in an early career stage. And I think it's pretty important. And I would ask you more about mentorship and coaching and how invaluable that is in the EHS profession as you kind of grew up from industrial hygiene into safety and still in the business.
Yeah, so it was critical. I ran into Fred 2 to 3 years into my career, right? And so it put me on this different path. And then I happened to run into the next manager that they hired for the organization was a gentleman by the name of John Longfellow. And he was well-renowned within the steel industry. You know, he would show up for work. He drove a Mercedes. And this is back in the 96, 97. And he'd get out and he'd be in greens. And he was greens with his steel toe boots. He was ready for work. And he looked like everybody else on the floor. And so, you know, he really set in motion, you know, kind of the thought processes around, you know, everybody has choices in life. You can never take their choices away from them. They can either understand what the rules are, make sure they make sense, make sure they're applicable. Because a lot of times I think we historically have pushed rules and expectations that make no sense. And if they don't make sense to the employees, they're going to buck it the whole time unless you're standing next to them, right? And so, but there's certain ones that you're never going to give up on. So safety glasses being one of them, hearing protection, hard hats, you know, the right PPE, the greens, yellows, whatever the company's wearing. And he goes, Michael, it's pretty straightforward. Make sure they know the rules. Make sure the rules make sense. You communicate them, give them a chance to comply with those rules. And then it's up to them. And they always have two choices. They can either comply and keep working, or they can go find work elsewhere. But they're not going to get themselves hurt or injured under my watch here. And they literally were the simplest rules in the world. Like it was, you hold on to 3 or 4 of them, and you hold on to them for dear life, and you enforce them to the end of the world.
So you would say you were really focused on the frozen middle, you know, the old terminology of the frozen middle. What else would you attribute your success to at that particular time in your career at that location?
Well, leaning into that, it's a lot of it is, you know, like safety awareness, but it's trying to get that 80% in the middle, right? You got the 10% that if you offer, they're the ones that, you know, you say, hey, we're gonna start a new program of walking. The first one's there, and they're gonna take off and walk, right?
We call those people cave people. If you've ever heard that terminology.
Oh, the allegory of the cave?
No, the citizens against virtually everything is who you're describing there with that 10%.
No, that's the bottom.
That's the other side.
That's the other side.
Oh, okay. I'm talking about the first 10 that'll, you say, hey, we're going to paint the floor, and they show up with paint ready to go, right?
Like, understood. Okay.
I don't worry about them, okay. Right? Like, because whatever we say, they're going to just jump in and do it.
Okay.
It's the 80% in the middle, because you got the 10% you're talking about.
Yep.
No matter what you do, you're not going to bring them along, no. Right? They're just going to stay there. They're going to fight you. They're going to argue with you. I never worry about them. I mean, don't get me wrong. I always worry about them, yeah. But I'm not trying to move them to the middle. I'm trying to drag that 80% in the middle towards the 10. And the more I can drag that direction and get them pulling, the bottom 10, some of them will start to slide up, right? And then the rest of them, again, I go back to, they always have two options. They can either stay with us and do what's expected, or they can go find somewhere else to work. And I'm happy for them. You know, if you don't like what you're doing here, then I'm happy to let you go find somewhere else to go work.
Now, Jay, I just heard some real practical things there. First of all, to realize that you explain things, let people have choices, and realize it's up to them. But the other thing I heard was said was, we spend all this time blaming the employees. It's us. It's the management team that hasn't set things up right. Sometimes hasn't even set the right example for it. And then that idea of the 10-80-10, that's really important for people, because that's what we're trying. We're in this process of trying to guide people closer to where they need to be. Oh, you learned some good lessons there, Michael.
I did. Early.
Early on.
Early.
Fortunately, by coming, you know, you came across some good people.
Yes, I did.
And you also got dropped into the proverbial fire coming out of industrial hygiene and going into a steel mill. What did that do to your career? I mean, obviously, you moved from IH to safety, but let's be honest, that's probably one of the most dangerous places to work on the planet.
Yep.
And you were taking that on at a young age without a mentor, like, fresh. And what did that do for you and your psyche for the rest of your career, that learning experience?
Well, first going through it almost killed me.
No doubt.
You know, during my tenure there, we had 9 different fatalities that we had to deal with and handle. And I had to work with, you know, I had to work with OSHA almost on a weekly basis. And, you know, coming out of school, you think, oh, OSHA's the good guys. Like, they're the truth seekers. They're only looking for what's right. And for the most part, they are. But I would say they're more trying to hit the middle, especially when you're dealing with steel workers and they got all this pressure, right, from them. And so it was an eye-opening experience for me to kind of get, you know, grounded in, okay, don't look at OSHA. And as a matter of fact, if I have to crack open the OSHA book, I feel like I failed because my policies and procedures don't. They clearly, everything should outweigh and outpace anything OSHA's got in the reg books. But it was a great learning experience, because you're right. Nothing in the steel industry is trying to injure you. It's trying to kill you. Kind of understanding and getting experiences to, you know, why people do it. At some point, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about SOPs and JSAs and THAs and all of that stuff that we have in writing. But to the guy on the front line, none of that matters. Like, he's not opening his book to figure out what am I going to do? How do I do this? Like, he's just doing the job he thinks he's supposed to be doing. And so, and that's where for me, that's the moneymaker, is if I can get them to pause and think about what they're doing and give it a thought, like, is this safe? Is it not safe? And if, you know, and then go to work. Because you can do some of the craziest things in the world and you do it safely and never get hurt, right? And then you get guys that are just shoveling coal out of the back of the bunker.
Is it safe to say you're a believer there's the OSHA recordable injury and then there's the serious injury fatality sort of injury, and you're leaning towards that? That's if that's what you want to go after versus maybe a back strain or an ergonomic issue. And I mean the severe kind. I'm not making light of any incidents, mind you, but the ones that concern me day in and day out are those, the ones you're describing.
Yeah, I think there's, for me, and again, as I've changed careers and kind of moved around, I've gone into those industries where companies where their recordable rate was really low, and they wanted me to focus on, you know, there was a plug in the floor that was put there years ago, and they're like, you got to pull that out because that's a trip hazard. Like, I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about the machine that's running outside, you know, and people are putting their hands in it. Like,
but no one's ever got hurt on that machine before. We've been doing it this way for so many years.
Well, you've been listening to
so you know this story. So I do think, you know, things are going to happen, right? And I don't worry about when somebody says, oh, I was walking down and I rolled my ankle. I've rolled my ankle just walking on a perfectly great floor, right? Like, it just kind of happens. But what I do worry about are the things I can control is, you know, the ergonomics, the lifting, the sort tables, the how are we picking things up? Is it repetitive? How can I make that better for them? And then obviously the big ones, right? Like I think zero is clearly, you know, achievable, but sometimes to get to zero, you gotta, there's law of diminishing returns. And to get to that, like I don't know that it's worth that level of scrutiny.
Well, this is the part in the podcast series that invites a lot of controversy these days. You know, the can you achieve zero versus you cannot achieve zero. I'm on the side that you're describing. I want to achieve zero. I think I can. But as you said, the law of diminishing returns, can I grind it to an absolute halt? I don't know. And am I worried about the coffee spill? I'm more worried. The worst industrial accidents I've been exposed to in my career are walking down the steps from a distribution center, looking at your iPhone, missing the last three steps and shattering your ankle. I mean, I've had some, those have been the ones for me.
All right. Well, since we're attacking sacred cows right now.
Whoa.
And issues.
Are we?
I've got one a statement that is often said.
Uh-oh.
Is the one of safety is our top priority.
Oh, that kind of hurts me. Wait, before you answer that, I gotta take that in, because I'll tell you this. When I hear anybody say that or put it in writing, first it goes through me. Probably why I need some of my peanut M&Ms here to the crew back here. But it goes right through me, because I look at you, whoever said it, wrote it, or brought it to fruition and said the P word, priority. I know you are full of it and don't mean any of it. That's me. I'll ask you.
Yeah, well, that's why we're going to see what Michael would say about
it. It goes right through me as a guest host. Go ahead, Michael.
No. I, without question, it's one of my, like, it causes the hair on the back of my neck to stand
up. It just did. I don't have any, too, and I can feel I'm growing some right now.
So I think it goes back to the, you know, like, well, we had to say something. We didn't know what to say. We wanted to tell you it was important. So we're just going to say it's our top priority. It's our number one priority. It's all hogwash. It's all hogwash. Because, you know, we developed this whole, well, I shouldn't say we, like it was translated from Fred's class, right, of safety awareness, and talking about safety is a value. And
who's talking, know, Fred Manuel?
No, sorry, Fred Ryan. So
Fred Ryan.
That's
that
the book.
That class.
One of the first classes. And
okay.
So
good.
So when Merle and I got to work together and we put this thing together, we really put it around safety can't be a priority. If we're being honest with ourselves and we're being honest with the employees, they know it's not a priority. But what is it? It's more of a value. And it's a value from the perspective of everything we do, everything we work at, every material we produce, whatever it is, if it's a widget, if it's a bearing, if it's, you know, part of an airplane, everything has to have quality. It has to be made safely. So, you know, if I can't make it safely, we're not going to make it. Let's make it safely, because if I can do that safely, I joke around a lot when I talk to people about this value versus priority and injuries. And I'm like, you know, Merle's got extra people sitting on the sidelines. He's got bench people. So he's okay if Jay gets hurt, because he's just going to grab another guy off the bench. He's got extra employees. And constantly the manager's like, I don't have anybody extra. And I'm like, I know you don't have anybody extra, because if you did, HR would have found them. The CEO would have taken them out. Like, we don't have extra people. So if I start hurting people and we say it doesn't matter, just get the production out, and if you get hurt, that's all right, I got somebody else I'm going to move in, well, it hurts it down the line, because now I'm moving somebody that's not as effective as Merle. Now Jay's got to come in, you're great at your job, you kind of know his job, so you're going to be slower, which means I got to now do your job. Mm-hmm. And it just falls down the train, and it ultimately hurts production. So as I start talking about safety, normally I talk about the two as being together. Production and safety work together. We're not opposed from each other. We are a for-profit organization. Every organization I work for is for-profit. I don't hide from that. I don't run from that. We're here to make money. Merle is the CEO of Merle Incorporated. He's here to make money for Merle. And so when we start talking about values, you know, that has to go through every decision that Merle makes. And we want that filter to be, it's top quality. I can do it safely. I can make this thing happen. And if I can, I should stop. because if I get hurt, I just hurt Merle Incorporated. Now, you also hurt the company, but ultimately hurts Merle Incorporated. And so so it just kind of all we try to tie it together. And I've never run from, you know, trying to say, hey, you know, that's business. It's not business and safety against each other. It's we're together, right, in this process.
I would constantly tell my team that if there's no economy, there is no safety.
Yeah.
There really isn't us if we're not helping safely make X.
So there's two things that, to go back to your zero comment, right? First is, I guarantee I can achieve zero injuries if I padlock the doors and never let somebody come in. Zero, yeah. Right? I make zero.
Fair.
The other zero comment that I have used and I agree with is zero for today. Let's achieve zero injuries for today.
Well said.
And if we make it today, I can build upon that tomorrow. But if when companies say I got zero for the year, if I'm the employee in January 1, somebody goes out, twists an ankle, and becomes recordable, I'm done for the year. Now where's the motivation?
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
So I like the whole zero for a day kind of concept, because if we miss it for today, that's okay. The other thing that I think people miss, and that's what I learned in Granite City, what I learned in the steel company, is you can take some of the safest organizations you think on paper and by everything they publish and everything they do and everything that's out there, and all it takes is one employee to make one decision you wish they didn't make. Irregardless of all the training and all the SOPs and JSAs and all that stuff put together, one bad decision by them at the moment, you'd think the whole thing's done. Yep. And it's a blink of an eye. And so the more you can get into, you're the CEO of your company. Think about what you're doing for you. Like, if you gave me $1 billion today, I wouldn't be sitting here tomorrow, right? Like, I'm not working. And I think everybody's that way. So they do it because they need money. They fund what they want to do for a living. And so, you know, when you talk about them being the CEO of your own company in those aspects, trying to get to do it safely, because nobody wants you to get hurt.
So those fatalities early on in your career really, as you would guess, had a tremendous impact on how you operate, how you lead.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, Michael, you've worked for a variety of different companies, and companies of different sizes, some extremely large and profitable companies and well-known companies, and some not so well-known. And I had here in the notes that there was a time that you were talking with people about, and they knew all the numbers except safety numbers. Could you tell us about that story?
Yeah, so as I kind of moved up the chain, you know, when I went north to the organization a year and a half after being in the plant, I got promoted into being the director for the global company. And global footprint, 26 countries, like all over the place. And everything we've talked about to this point, didn't matter where I was at, it applied, whether it was in Malaysia, China, Europe, Brazil. Like it all resonated with people, which I found interesting. But then when I got, after that role, I got promoted up to the parent company. And I found it to be interesting because we had profit reviews and we had different mechanisms to go study things. And literally they would put together these slides and, you know, it would take 6 months putting this presentation together for the parent company. And it was a 3-slide deck presentation when it first started, then it went to 2. And they always said you knew where to stand, right? And I knew this from being below that process, because it was the bloody spot on the floor for the guy in front of you just got bludgeoned for not knowing the answers and not knowing the details. So you kind of knew where to stand and then work your way through the slides. So when I got into that organization, by the way, there was no bludgeoning.
No.
Just the beatings, not literal. Just,
yeah,
not
the beatings will continue until morale improves.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't literal, but it was darn near, right? Like if you were in those meetings, it was darn near. But when I got to the next level up in the organization, it really did surprise me because the organization I was in, they knew all the numbers. They knew their safety numbers. They knew their environmental numbers. They knew like the whole shebang. Most of the other companies didn't. And even the parent company didn't even know what the total accumulation of all their businesses together was. Like, how many people around the globe are we hurting? What's our lost time rate? What's our recordable rate? Are we counting that? And the gentleman I replaced, and I'll never forget this, the one thing they said at his retirement was, you almost got record keeping in Europe completed for the companies. And he'd been there 30 years. And I remember looking at my wife, and then I looked at the admin, and I said, if that's what they say at my retirement, kill me now. Like, because wow. Like, that's not happening. So I took the mentality of where I came from, brought it to the parent company, and within 2 to 3 months, we had record keeping across the organization. Was it perfect? Probably wasn't perfect, but we at least were starting to get numbers and starting to figure out who's the best, who's the worst. And we could see some really strong trends, right, of what was going on. And so we created this, we called it the Focus 12, but there were other names that those 12 companies had for that list, and some of them were not so nice.
If you were in the Focus 12, what did that mean?
That meant you were the worst performing TRIR, total recordable rate. So all they'd really measured before was lost time. Now, lost time didn't include restricted. So it was only lost time. So they could have closet fulls of walking wounded.
As long as they got them back to work.
Yep. Come on in. Yeah. Come on in and work.
That doesn't count as an injury.
Correct. So it wouldn't show up. So we moved to the...
How did people respond at first with this idea? You're doing something new and different. How'd they go over at first? Were they happy with you?
Oof. No. No.
Of course not.
No, they were not. Because the biggest thing they said was, besides that I could at least stay on air, was you moved the cheese. We're having great success in lost time. Now you went to recordables. What are you doing? And I went to recordables because I knew you can't hide that. Mm-hmm. Right, you can hide your closet full of walking wounded, and I may not be able to see that or can't get to it, but I can get to the recordable. I can stop the recordables or bring focus to it. That clearly up the chain makes a difference.
Would this be correct? Did you have somebody that said, some executive in one of those divisions that said to their safety person, I don't care what you do, but get me off this list?
So leaning into the simple answer is yes, but part of it was leaning into the competitive nature of operations folks, mm-hmm. right? Like, nobody likes to be a deluder to, and that was in the phrases we would use is, you know, here's where the company is, and if you're to the right of that, you're diluting that number. So stop diluting my number and let's get to a level. And it wasn't even close. Like, it was, you had companies that were sub ones within this organization. And then you had companies that when we did the recordable rate, they were 8, 9s. And they were like, this is okay. Like, what are you talking about? To the point where in one of those reviews we were talking about with the slides, and you know where to stand, right? And we would prep them going into those meetings, and we would say, hey, so what are you gonna say here? And they stood up in front of me and were like, nothing. Like, we're doing great. Like, our lost time rate has gone down. Things are looking good. And, you know, that's only because you changed the metric on us is why we look so bad. And I go,
oh,
I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. I would be humble. And I would say, we've got work to do. You know, things have changed. There's things that we're looking at differently, but it's the right path. And we're going to work on this to get this better.
Did they listen to you?
Nope.
I feel really uncomfortable knowing that answer right now.
Oh, it was fantastic. It was fantastic because I knew because the COO that was going in, he was very much what would be the word?
Advocate.
He was advocate.
A zealot and advocate.
Yes.
Because he had been in operations as he worked his way up and had faced fatalities.
Yes.
Okay.
And so he walked into that meeting. And again, this is 6 months in prep to get ready for this meeting. He walks in, sat down, and it's quite the show, right, to put on. You got the top leaders of that company plus the top leaders of the other company coming together to say, let's work on the plan and figure out what we're going to do in the next year. And they're up there going. They get to the safety section, and it's fairly early in the presentation, which is a full eight-hour presentation. And they start with the whole, you know, our lost time, you know, Michael's moved the cheese. We don't like this. You know, this is not fair. And you know, immediately my head went down because it was like the spire in Lord of the Rings. He immediately looked up and it was like, don't look at him. Like now he's laser focused on the guy at the front. And he said something to the effect of, we're not going to normalize hurting people. We're not going to accept that. This is not part of the making production. And he literally closed his book and said, you guys need to rewrite the plan. We're coming back in 3 weeks and I don't want to hear that again. Got up and we left.
Wow.
Left.
What happened?
I have this quote too, where he said, we're not going to rationalize hurting people over profits.
Yes, that was it.
And that's what that guy said. And they said, close the book, go back and figure out something. We're not going to rationalize hurting people over profits.
Which is 100% leading with a value of safety.
Is it?
My question, follow-up is, I'm dying to know what happened 3 weeks later. Actually, I'm dying to know what happened 30 seconds later outside of the room. When you came face to face with that, did you leave with that person who just?
Yeah, I was on the plane. You didn't miss the plane.
Wow.
So you had to leave. Yeah. So, and then we clearly, there was a lot of discussion going back and we were like, we told you not to do that. Like,
what was the reaction? And how did you handle that as a leader to either,
I told you so.
You could have took two differing approaches. I told you so. You should have listened to me and here's how you better fix it. Or I'm here to help you and this is what I would do. Let's go back over this again. Clearly just meeting you, knowing you took that road. How did it go and how did they respond? And what would you attribute the success of their response to?
I would attribute the success to that response was the COO that shut down the whole thing, got up and said, we're not doing this no more. We're done. Like no conversation, no back and forth. No, let's figure it out. It was close the book, go back, figure it out. And then we'll be back in 3 weeks or whatever the time was, but we'll be back and we're going to go through this again, but you better not say that.
I'm dying to know the rest of the story. Can we got it.
Well, they got, I mean, we eventually went from 12 to 8 to 4 to done because everybody had kind of flattened out the organization. And so, you know, we had, I don't remember what the numbers are anymore because it's been a few years since then, but it was the first time ever that everybody was kind of in a level playing field across all of the platforms. Mm-hmm. And what's funny is when I talk with Ed Purvis, who was the last guy I talked to that day when I left the company, he's like, you know, Michael, he's like, the one thing you did was you did your job too well. The recordable rate's too good. You did it, you know, too quickly. And, you know, we think we have a better approach to maintain that as we move forward. And they have maintained that. And they've done, you know, as they divested companies and bought companies and done some other things, but overall their structure and, you know, what they realized was we did it without spending millions of dollars or this huge program rollout of
no flavor of the month to help you through.
No flavor of the month, just, you know, recognition. There was a lot of recognition that we would do and we changed how we did that so that everybody was kind of competing within certain categories. Because prior to that, you would get, you know, we called it the Hunk of Plastic Award, but it was an acrylic award. Mm-hmm. But we were all competing in the same pools and you had companies that worked millions and millions of man hours a year competing against companies that are working 10,000 man hours a year. Like those two aren't the same. Like, you know, so we structured things so that we understood, hey, you know, let's recognize the successes. Let's not always beat up on the guys that, you know, are not performing. But even those meetings changed from a safety perspective because they knew their numbers now. Mm-hmm. Like they started to understand we're not going to be the worst. We're going to be one of the best, if not the first. And they drove it themselves. Like they started focusing on it. And when you get operations folks focusing, look out, just get out of their way.
And so here's a guy, and for everybody that's listening to this podcast, here's a guy that went in and you resisted the system didn't like what you were going to do. The people didn't want it, but he had enough guts to do it. And it's changed. Now, you certainly had an advocate in that champion. And how valuable is having a champion that was a COO? How important is it? And is there a way for people to develop that?
Well, I mean, I guess from that perspective, I was lucky that he kind of, he didn't have a leader from a safety perspective, I don't think, until I came on board. And once we gave them the path and showed the direction and started doing some things, you know, that's when he realized, like, hey, this isn't a heavy lift. This is pretty straightforward. And I guess one of the other things that we hadn't gotten into, but at that same company is where I met Merle, who I would say is my third mentor, and really started helping us change, you know, the whole program. And we took a training program around the globe, and I don't know, it was 700, 800 train the trainers that we did. And we didn't pass everybody, but you know, it was a fun class because we put it together with kind of a combination of what, you know, that company was doing from an HR perspective and added some safety perspectives to it. And in that class, we never once talked about how to be safe. We never talked about procedures and policies. It was all about the why, like what makes it important. And it was supervisors and above. And it was a fantastic.
And Jay, what just so you know, we called safety leadership skills. And we haven't said anything about Dale Carnegie yet in this time, but we really weaved a bunch of Dale Carnegie principles mm-hmm. and methodology of teaching in that course. And it was accepted globally around the world. And it really did, like Michael said, it really affected how do you lead people and help people? How do you arouse in the other person an eager want? That's what we were working toward. In that. Did we always get it? No, but we were working toward that, the want to of safety. And Michael, before we wrap up, there's an illustration that you came up with about your and I'd like you to tell it because I think the listeners could put to use or think about that. They can track you down and get more about it. But give us that idea of how you use that.
Yeah. So I was with a company that has lots of drivers around the U.S. And one of our major issues were and we have across the U.S. today, is distracted driving. And they kept saying, you know, stop being distracted, stop looking at your cell phone, stop, you know, you're causing rollovers, we're having all these accidents.
How'd that go over?
It wasn't moving the needle because it was just white noise, right? Like, stop being distracted.
So, like your slip, trip, fall program we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, kind of like that. And so I came up with this idea coming home, a 13-hour drive from PA back to St. Louis. And my team always hated that drive because I would come up with these ideas of let's try this. And so one of them was this thing called marble jar. And in it, because every time, you know, you think about distractions, every time you pick up a cell phone, nothing happens. And from every time you're distracted, every time something is going on in the car, 9 times out of 10, nothing happens, right? If the first time you picked up your cell phone, you had an accident, you'd never touch it again. But that's not what happens. And so we started kind of playing with this idea of how do I get that in the hands of my drivers so that it can be something we can play with, we can have some fun with. So we built this jar and we built 700 of them and sent them out across the globe or the US. And most of them were filled with white marbles, which means nothing happens, right? And I forget what the percentages was. It was like 70.
About how many
15.
Marbles you think you had in a jar? 100?
In the ones we sent out, I think there was probably about 50.
Okay.
50 or 60. I don't know. My team had to source these marbles. It was not fun for them. And then we had to count them. It was really, they were not a fan,
yeah.
But they loved the program. So, but in this jar, you had mostly white, which meant nothing happened. Right. And then you had these blue marbles and the blue marble represented, I almost ran into somebody. So if you've ever been in a turn, right, for example, and somebody's in front of you and you're going to merge to the right, mm-hmm. have you ever been there and you thought they went because you were looking for a gap? You see the gap come, you go, and you look up, and they're still sitting there, and you stop short, right? Mm-hmm. You get really hyper-focused at that point. So that's what blue meant. Then there were reds. Reds was you actually had an accident or an incident, fewer of those. And in every jar, we had one black marble. And the black marble didn't mean you died or had a fatality, but you had a really serious incident that changed your life forever in some form or fashion. And so we sent those out. And what we would do is we would say, hey, the program was, hey, as you drove in today, how many times were you distracted? And that could be looking at a billboard, changing the radio station, changing the thermostat, trying to figure out what the car in front of you, what their license plate was, or it could be cell phone, whatever it was. And so we were doing this. And then however many distractions you had, you would blindly pull out marbles. So you couldn't look. So you had to look away and you put them in this bag that was opaque. You couldn't see through the bag. And then we would go around and whoever was playing with us, you'd pull a marble out. And you kept pulling a marble till you hit a blue, a red, or the black. And so happened to me in California, and we were doing this exercise. And we had, by the way, we had video clips that would go with it that they could choose which video clip they wanted to watch. Nothing for the white marbles. And this guy said, oh, I'm driving in today, 14 times I was distracted. Okay, so he's reaching the jar, pulls out 14, puts them in his bag. He was the first one up, and he reaches into the bag because, again, you couldn't see. So you would reach in the bag, and he pulled out a marble. And the first marble he pulled was a black marble.
Whoa, what was his reaction?
And he's like, I'm done for the day. Like, I'm this is a bad omen. I'm going home. Like, no, just relax. Like, let's continue to go through this. But and played the clip, and I think it was a rollover or something that the clip was. And I said, I'm just curious because now you're done with the game. But however, what's the other color of marbles you had? 13 marbles were all white. Mm. One marble was black. And it really goes to the whole, if you knew you were going to pull the black marble, you wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
You would pay attention, right? And so they use that still today. They do it for new hires, everybody coming on board. And what it really says is when they see you doing something that's distracted, they go, hey, Merle, you got your hand in the marble jar. Like, eventually you're going to pull one you don't want. Stop putting your hand in the marble jar. Mm. And it's a different way to kind of think about.
And that is brilliant. And everybody that's listening to this podcast needs to realize, dramatize your ideas. Because you can blah, 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 blah all day long. But through some illustration like that, all of a sudden it becomes, oh, crap, vivid. And people get it better.
Agreed.
Because they got to do something. And that's powerful. Well, Michael, it's been a pretty interesting time together. We kind of just going to let you think just for a second here. What piece of advice would you give to the folks that are listening right now? We've got folks that are newer in the field of safety, got veteran people here all over. Through your experiences, what piece of advice would you give these folks? They're out there trying their best. They're struggling sometimes. What would you suggest they think about?
Yeah, I mean, find your mentor. Find somebody that can help you answer questions. And don't find the people that are compliance. You know, it's more than that. And if you think about in your own life, you know, reflect on your own incidents and your own issues and own them. And don't run away from them. Don't shy away from them. And when you see Joe Schmo doing something that they shouldn't be doing, don't get on them. Just ask them, hey, do you know what you're doing? Do you know why you're doing it? Like, let's talk through this because clearly we're missing something. And it's not about, as much as we talk and work towards procedures and policies in the book, it's not about that. It has very little to do with it. You need those things. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say you don't have those, but it's the employee and making sure they understand what's in it for them and why do we do this and why is it important for you? And if you can make that connection, you'll be successful. And, you know, it's interesting. Nobody comes into this career looking for accolades, right? Like if you came into this career looking for a bunch of people to pat you on the back, you're in the wrong career. But you go home every night knowing we've saved some people's lives. We've changed the way people look at things. We've changed the way things happen. And if you can do that, you'll be wildly successful in your career.
Great. Thank you so much for being a part today.
Wonderful.
Thanks, guys. I enjoyed meeting you, Jay and Merle. It's always good to see you.
Yes, sir.
Jay, opportunity today to hear from a gentleman I've known for several years, watched him in action. It always comes back to that focus of not just I'm boss, but let's guide the people. Guide the people, help them to see where they're going, help them to know the choices they have. What was your takeaway today?
I think it was an awesome discussion on being dropped into the fire early on in your career, how you adapt, how you learn, finding an important mentor. And it was just a wonderfully awesome conversation for the EHS professional to hear today.
Thanks for listening to My Big Safety Challenge, a podcast produced in partnership by Dale Carnegie and BCSP, with your hosts, Dale Carnegie Master Trainer Merle Heckman and Jay Harf, Vice President of Global Environment, Health, Safety, and Sustainability at Xylem. Executive produced by Charlie Eltringham. The supervising producer is Joel Bergai. Directed by Jiachi Liu. Edited by Jared Griot and Kyla Anderson. Editorial support from Brandon Moha. Social media support from Braylon Morgan and Evelyn Baku. Consulting producers are Colin Brown and Mark Sullivan. To have new episodes delivered directly to you, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. If you would like to share your story of a safety leadership challenge you faced, email us at info@mybigsafetychallenge.com. See you next time.